David Harewood, when we saw each other at the another opening night of Cabaret, because they keep having the new cast, we had this fantastic conversation and you completely inspired my younger daughter because you were talking about being a member of the NYT National Youth. Is that where it all started for you?
I guess. I mean, it started at school. I was just a classroom clown who always used to mess about. I was rubbish at school. I never got education. I never got academia.
Because you weren't interested because you wanted to be
just
an actor?
It just didn't compute. You know, I was sort of having such a great time playing football and rugby and tennis with my mates and athletics. And I loved it as a club, as a place to go. I loved it. But the work you had to do when you were there sort of went over my head. And I can remember sitting in one of, I think it was an English exam, history exam. And I remember, you know, as you do, you flick through all the questions. And I'd flick through all the questions and I couldn't answer any of them. And I sort of looked round to giggle at my mates and they were all busy writing. And it suddenly hit me. I thought, they're on a different trajectory. You know, they'd revised.
You said rehearse.
I'd rehearse.
You see, yes, I know, I get that.
They had obviously been revising and getting their stuff together. And I suddenly turned around and thought, I'm different. And I blagged it through, I think I got a C or something.
Without writing anything? You're a genius, David. I'm impressed.
I wrote bits and pieces, but I think I got a C. I just about scraped a pass, but then started looking because I didn't want to go to university. I thought I can't do this, and suddenly a teacher called me up and said, "Come into the school." And I went into the school, and he said, "What are you going to do when you leave?" And I hadn't really got a clue, and I said, "I don't know, sir." And he said, "Well, we've been talking in the staff room, and we think you should be an actor."
It was an
absolute light bulb, eureka moment. I went, that makes total sense. And that was it. From that moment on, I decided to be an actor and audition.
He got a lot to thank that teacher.
I've met him since and thanked him. And
really?
Yeah, of course. Did a documentary where I went back to Birmingham.
Yeah, you went back to Birmingham.
And met him and we giggle about it.
But that is, you know, that was for the documentary, but I love the idea that you, as you know what I mean, away from all of that, that you call him up and you say that you were my light bulb moment.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people know or can remember what that moment was.
Oh, it's completely. That was it. And I auditioned then for the Birmingham Youth Theatre, got rejected, and about a week later auditioned for the National Youth Theatre and got accepted. And National Youth Theatre was the first time I found my tribe. You know, where you find your tribe of people. And I thought, this lot, I love this. All the improvising, the messing around. They were exactly like me, you know. And I suddenly thought, this is what I was born to do because I came alive. And all the silly voices and, you know, all of the stuff I did at the back of class, I was now doing in scene work. And it felt pretty easy for me because it came very naturally.
Does acting still feel like that now?
Pretty much. I mean, it's fun. And as long as it remains fun, that's a good sign.
Has it ever not been fun then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The acting?
Yeah.
Really?
When I was struggling, you know, I was struggling to, before I went to America, you know, I wasn't really working very much. And there's nothing like thinking, you got to pay the rent.
Yeah.
And, you know, some script comes through the door and you think, I don't want to do that, but I need the money. And, you know, that's where I was before I went to America. And I hated it. I hated those years of having to take jobs that I didn't want to do, but I needed to pay the rent.
So, but was that fire always burning, even when you did those jobs? It wasn't?
No. I mean,
oh, wow.
You know, if your heart's not in it, you know, it's a pretty soul destroying profession. I don't want to paint a picture that it's
no, it's the best job in the world when you're working.
When you're enjoying it,
yeah,
and when you're having fun, and which is 95% of the time. But you know, there have been times in my career where I've hated it, and that contributed to my breakdown. You know, going on stage drunk, going on stage high, just to get through it. I mean, it was just a nightmare. I hated it. So there have been times when I've totally lost the desire for it.
Why did you go on stage in that part if you were that unhappy? Or was it a case of paying the rent? Was that...
No, that was a job I'd taken. It was my second professional job. And I knew I shouldn't have done it. But I was sort of bullied into it. And I was very inexperienced. Mm. And I sort of got talked into it and hated it. Absolutely hated it. And it was a tour, one of these national tours. So you were jumping in a van and driving off to another location after 4 days. And as soon as it went up and opened, it was
I'm pleased you can laugh about it now.
I can now because, you know, I've written about it, but it was a really awful gig.
Yeah.
Three-hander. And one of them kept forgetting their lines and never knew what was going to come out of his mouth. And then the other one, who was playing my wife, just decided to stick a tongue down my throat one night on stage. And I was like, where did that...
What?
Yeah. I was like, where did that come from? And she kind of walked off stage and she was like, no, I'm changing all the blocking. I know what this play's about. And just decided to put it on me on stage. And I was obviously thrown by this.
Just a bit,
and
yeah.
Very uncomfortable. And she just decided that that's what the play was about and wouldn't leave me alone. And it was my second job out of drama school. I was fending off this, you know, rather this creature. And, you know, the other guy forgetting his lines. And it was just awful. And I had to do, and I had 4 months to go. So I had to get through it. Put my
head
down.
So you coped in the way that you knew, which was
drinking.
Smoked. Right.
It was the most unhappy I've ever been, and that certainly contributed to my breakdown.
Do you know? So what I love is that you obviously your book, which I've read, it's an incredible book. It's very funny as well.
It is, yeah.
It's very honest, but it is funny, and. And I remember thinking, oh, I don't know if I can say that it's funny. but you didn't do it. It's very serious and there's some very heavy parts of it, but there is humour there. And I'm talking to you now, I can see you saying about something that was the most unhappy time, and yet there is humour in it.
Yeah.
Those times.
I think I think once you can, I've done a lot of work, you know, on... in therapy and, by writing the book, making that documentary, investigating what all that was about, my breakdown was about. Done a lot of digging in and kind of looking at myself. And that's valuable work. And you sort of, if I hadn't have processed it, I probably wouldn't be able to laugh about it. But
at the time, you probably weren't laughing.
Not at all, no. It was horrendous. Horrendous experience.
Do you know what's so good as well, that you've been so honest about things that people don't usually talk about? Because people talk about mental health and as a sort of big, broad umbrella spectrum. But you talk about a part of it that not as many people are open about.
Which part is that?
Well, all the stuff, the psychosis, the voices, the all of those things. People, Joe Tresini, he talks about it now and everyone says, oh, that's what my child's like. Oh, that's what I'm like. And suddenly people go, I'm not a freak. I'm not on my own. And that's what you've done for a lot of people. Did you think doing your book and doing the documentary and everything, did you think I'm going to be helping a lot of people?
No. I was just curious at first. I thought, you know, I actually thought I was going to remember some of the more... use the word crazy, because you are euphoric. There's elements of euphoria, really hard, real euphoria before your crash. Most people who experience psychosis, particularly, and people who are bipolar as well, they have these real highs, talking 1,000 miles an hour, very, very fast, great ideas. Oh my God, this is a great idea. Let's go for a walk right now. And, you know, it's like you're in a heightened state of awareness. And there were some really incredible moments that I remember, and I thought I was going to find all that stuff, But I found all the trauma. Mm. And that was, I wasn't expecting that. And that then it sent me on a huge spiral where it took me about 4 years to process. Partly from seeing my medical records and seeing everything that I was speaking about and everything that I was, every drug I was given. The documentary didn't come out for another year after we made it. And by then I'd sort of righted the ship, and I didn't watch it when it came on TV.
You didn't?
No. I picked up anxiety in the house. And I was right. My wife said, you know, what about the kids? You know, they're going to go to school tomorrow and someone's going to say something. And I hadn't even thought about that. And I suddenly thought, God, I've really messed up here. And I've really, and then an advert came on the telly and I was like, oh my God. And I was really panicking. And I thought, oh, I ruined my career.
Did you really?
Yeah, I really, that? I thought for a moment, I thought I'd ruined my career. And I thought, you know, as an actor, I guess there's a degree of mystique required. But I literally ran naked through the village. I went, yeah. And I suddenly realized, and when it was the night it was on, that I'd really let people in. And I was really panicking about that. But literally, as soon as it finished, and I didn't watch it, I went to bed. And I was just about to drift off to sleep, and it must have finished because every device in my house was beeping, buzzing, vibrating, making noises. And they were all emails and text messages and voice messages from people just saying, brilliant. Oh my God, amazing. Had no idea. Why haven't you told me about this? And some really lovely, warm messages from people I really respect.
And you hadn't told them?
No.
Interesting.
And then... Literally the next day, I couldn't walk 2 meters without someone stopping me in the street and sort of saying, thank you. You know, that happened to my mom or that happened to my dad. And you're standing on the street corner, literally blubbing your eyes out because it's a really emotional thing.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect any of that. I didn't expect any of it. And actually for a couple of weeks, it left me quite vulnerable because I didn't quite know.
Well, you have. As you said, you ran through naked.
Yeah.
Everybody saw everything.
Very uncomfortable.
Your insides, your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions. But you did help people. So the fact that you know that now, looking back, are you pleased that you did it now?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, I was pleased when I did it then. I just had to get...
You had to go through those couple of weeks.
Go through it. And, you know, writing the book was a further examination of it, much deeper examination of it, because I actually read my medical records, and that sent me down a huge rabbit hole. Reading your disturbed 20-year-old self that was over-medicated and locked in a mental institution. Yeah. It's quite...
Do you remember that time?
Yeah. I remember moments of it, yeah. Vividly.
Even though you were heavily medicated?
Yeah. I can remember certain mornings or, you know, getting out of bed certain mornings. There's lots of it that I recount in the book, the thing about the calendar.
I remember the calendar.
I remember that.
Yeah.
You know, the little moments that are very vivid for me. And then some moments when you suddenly go, oh my God, that's where that memory comes from.
Here's a weird thing though. Are you at the stage now where you don't want to talk about it anymore because you feel you've talked about it enough?
I'm only at that stage because I fear someone listening to this podcast might say, he said that before. and you know, I've now been back 2 years. From America, and it's almost a little bit like, oh, David Hale's back. You know, can we get him in? And
no, I didn't know. I mean, I've interviewed you before, and it wasn't like that at all. I can't even remember the very first time I interviewed you. It was so many years ago.
Yes,
but you've always struck me as somebody who's passionate about what you do, and I like people who are passionate. But you were never this open because adversity. That wasn't all out then.
I would say...
You were an actor.
Yeah, I'm a different person. And the doc and the book and the therapy has been... I wish I'd have done it years ago.
Mm.
I really do. I wish I'd have... I feel like I've been a bit of a phony for about 30 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, gosh. That's quite a heavy thing to put on your own shoulders.
But it's only because all the stuff I found during making the documentary That's the real stuff. And, yeah. and that has cracked open my sort of outer shell of bullshit and made me have a real look inside. And I feel so much more honest and so much more myself, which is, I'm glad I did it. Because at least
well,
now...
Well, hello, David.
Hello, hello, David.
Hello, David. There you are. David. There you are. But, okay, so let's go to America, because you said, you know, all that awful show that you were doing, Three-Hander. This is all before you went to America. Mm. And then suddenly it all changed for you.
Yeah.
So you were living the actor's dream. So all of my friends who trained at GSA with me, or everybody said, you know what, one day I want to make it in America. That move and doing it, mm. did you have the job before, or did you go to America first and then get the job?
No, well, you'd go, there's this awful thing called pilot season where, you know, everybody decamps to LA, and it's a bit of a cattle market. You know, you turn up there, no one knows who you are, and you walk, it's next, you know, it's that sort of thing. And there's like 100 people in the outer room, some of them gorgeous, some of them overweight, some of them black, some of them white, some of them... You know, and you just think, you're looking around going, he's going to get the part. Oh, no, he's going to get the part.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, well, he's going to get the part. And then you sort of, and then it's your turn, and you walk in and you do it, and thank you, next. And that was, I did that for a couple of years, because my agent, when I signed with him.
A couple of years?
Yeah. I signed with an agent, and she was very much aware of where I was in my career, which was, you know, you get to a point. And what I did is, and I think a lot of black actors get to that point in this country where you've just hit the ceiling. There's just nothing for you to do. And even though I had a great young actor, I had a great time. But when you reach that maturity, you need a part. You need good, juicy parts, and they just weren't there.
Because you're a black actor, or because of an actor of a certain age, you think?
I would say. Because they don't write them for black actors.
Right.
Or they don't think of black actors in for the... If you think about it, in my lifetime, there's only two dramas that I can remember that have got a black lead actor. Two. In my entire lifetime. I've been acting for 35 years. And I can think of Idris in Luther.
Yeah, in Luther.
And Hustle. Adrian.
Adrian
Lester. Two.
That's very shocking.
So if you think about that, that's just how special, you know, those opportunities are for black actors.
And they shouldn't be.
Exactly.
That's I mean, why, that's just crazy.
That's why I did, you know, I my agent knew I had to get to America. I knew I, because there's more work there, more opportunity there. So I did the cattle call for a couple of years.
Yeah. What were you doing in between?
Picking up bits here and picking up bits there. That's when I started to fall out of love with it, because I'm clearly, you know, I'd walk off stage playing Othello. And then be up for, you know, four lines in a BBC drama. And you think, well, why haven't I got the lead? Why aren't I the lead? Why can't I get a better part in that?
Yeah.
And it was just, so it was a couple of years of real frustration, because I couldn't crack television here. Mm. Even though I'd done a lot of television and done a lot of work. Maybe I should have been choosy, I don't know. But I just kind of hit that ceiling. And it just did the same. Lenny James did the same. Eamon Walker did the same. And they all went to America and had successful careers. So that was the path for black actors. Once you get known here and then you can't get to that next level, you head over to stateside. And it's, for the younger actors, it's now a well-trodden path. So the likes of Daniel Kaluuya and...
a lovely lad.
Wonderful lad. But again, without having to go through the trauma of all the bullshit that we had to go through, he made a couple of good shows here and then gone. And that's the journey for young black actors now.
But it should be here. Sorry, it should actually be available here.
It's still
not. It's wrong.
It's still not. It's and you know, I've been back 2 years, as I said, been back 2 years, and most of the really good, juicy scripts I get are still American.
Let's stay in America before we come back here, because... Homeland, of course, massive show. I remember interviewing you before you went to America. Then I remember interviewing you when you were in Homeland and you were back here doing interviews. And you were loving it.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I loved it. I mean, look, I mean, I, the, when I when I got Homeland, I hadn't worked for a year. My best friend had just passed away. So I was kind of emotionally a bit sort of broken. There hadn't been any work. I did a job at the National Theatre. First job in like 9 months I did this, and it was wonderful, but it was a great piece. Welcome to Thebes, it was called. Richard Eyre was directing. And I got the call to say, oh, my American manager said, oh, there's a script here called Homeland, and you should put yourself up for it. And I didn't have the confidence to do it. I said, no, I can't do that. And he sent it to me again and said, put yourself on tape. So I recorded it on my phone, not this very phone, but on my phone, stuck it on the windowsill, press record, did the whole thing, sent it off thinking they'll never watch that. And they did watch it.
I love that, you see.
And within 2 weeks of doing the audition, I was...
2 weeks?
Yeah. I remember because it was around Christmas when we finished, and they were shooting early January, and they couldn't find anyone to play the role. That's why they were searching. They couldn't find someone to play David Estes. Couldn't find the right actor. And it started off as a white actor, then it went to sort of female, and then they thought, no, that doesn't work, and let's just...
Because you were the right one. They saw you and you were the right one.
Yeah, I was in the literally right place, right time. So,
but that changed your life, didn't it? Is that dramatic?
Totally.
Too dramatic?
Okay. Well, from being skint,
yeah,
and you know, pretty broken, I was a year later, I'm you know, living in America and you know, at the Golden Globes, you know, walking past De Niro, DiCaprio, all the other D's.
Did you stop and talk to them?
Yeah, of course I did.
Good.
I grabbed Sidney Poitier, even Sidney Poitier, on the way to the bog.
What did you say?
I was on the way to the bog, okay, and I saw him. I went, oh my God. And I just literally, I was Mr. Shaky Hands. I just put my hand down. And I was shaking his hand going, you have no idea how much you meant to me. I'm so, it's just, and I was like completely fanboying. And he must have looked at me and thought, you know, who the hell's this? But I just said, you mean so much to me and thank you so much for all your work. It's just an honour and you know, all the fluff.
Did he say anything?
No, I think he was just a bit overwhelmed.
No, I love that. So you actually shook his hand.
Completely, yeah. Grabbed him, missed the shaky hand.
Oh,
wouldn't
see,
let him go.
I love that. And you need to do those things. I think, you know, I much prefer it when people are like that. I've done it to a few people. I sort of get sort of blubbery and go, I can't believe it. I remember doing it to somebody and at the time, the guy that I was with said, I can't believe you just did that. I said, do you know what? I'm going to be able to tell my grandchildren that I shook his hand.
Yeah.
It's that feeling.
And you know, a lot of people would rather that than, can I have a selfie?
Yes.
You know what I mean? A selfie is nothing. And in fact, I worked with Lawrence Fishburne in South Africa one time. And every time someone asked him for a selfie, he'd say, no, but let's have a chat. Let's have a chat. How are you? How's your day? And have that little bit of interaction and then say, off you go. See you later. Cheers, all the best. Thanks. Nice meeting you. Rather than the...
Yeah,
that
and
means
off you go.
Nothing. So I understand why people would prefer that, to have someone come up to them and say, shake your hand and give you a good boosting rather than, can I just have a selfie?
Yeah,
outside Tesco's.
So anyone that's listening, shake their hand. Don't ask for a selfie. So Homeland happened and then... So do you feel... I mean, obviously then, Supergirl and my 16-year-old, she's 16 now, but at the time, and she was watching it and you were on, I said, oh, I know him. No, you don't, Mum. I do. I've interviewed him recently. No, you haven't. It was a few years ago. I went, no, I really have. She went, no. And she just, it was so funny. Mm. Like, no, he's in Supergirl. You sort of... Yeah. Untouchable, unreal.
And then imagine me in Tesco's in Streatham. Well, I love it because people look at you and go, how are you here?
That's lovely, though. That's normal.
It is. And I'm very normal to a fault, I think. I think sometimes you need to, maybe you need to give yourself a bit of a boosting. I don't know. But
have you had somebody come and do the handshake with you?
Oh, loads.
Oh, I see. And what did they say? I hope you get young black actors coming up to you and saying thank you because you've...
I do, I get a lot of that. And I'll tell you one really special one I had the other day. And again, all your listeners probably heard these stories now. But I was walking down Streatham High Road and this rather large black gentleman kind of spotted me across the road and just made a beeline for me. I thought, oh, here we go. And he just grabbed my hand and I could kind of see him sort of welling up. He was welling up. And I was like,
oh.
And he said, I just want to say, I was in prison when I watched your documentary. And I'm like, what? He went, yeah. He said, I was on one. And the guard said to me, you need to watch this documentary from this guy, David Harewood. And I said, I fobbed him off. He said, but the next day I was really not in a good state of mind. And I asked him for the keys to the library. I said, when? And I got your documentary. And he said, I burst into tears. He said, it's the first time I realised I've got a mental health condition. I've got depression. And he said, I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't seen your documentary. I just want to say thank you very much. He just walked off.
That's very special.
That, for me, is worth all the awards.
Of course it is. That's really special. Wow. See, and look, there'll be so many others that haven't come up to you and said that you're going to have had. But let's go back to the escapism and the joy of acting. Yep. For you, now you're back here.
Mm-hmm.
If you get the call from America, is it jump on a plane and go straight back again?
Pretty much.
It is.
But you know, I mean,
you've just done that amazing show in the West End and, you know, rave reviews again. You know, I don't know if you read reviews. I don't know how you cope with the reviews, but they were great. And just in case you haven't read them, congratulations.
I read a few and yeah, I was really pleased. We were all really pleased with the piece. That's the business. The business is the business. And you know, that play came to an end and there wasn't really anything there. You know, it's not like, I mean, people think I'm like fending off scripts and wading through scripts as I walk in the door. It's not like that. And, you know, unfortunately, there was a lot of opportunities after the play towards the end of the run. There were, you know, a few offers of work, but they just weren't good enough.
Right.
And
they weren't the things that you wanted
to
do.
Not the things that I want to do.
Right.
And I've done a lot. And so it's got to be something which is pretty good to get me out of bed. And, you know, because of the work I've done in the States, I'm comfortable. You know, I can afford to say no for a bit.
But that's the strongest thing, to say no.
Yeah.
In anything, whatever job it is, it's not just acting and music and all the rest of it. To be able to have the strength inside you to say, actually, that's a no.
Yeah, thanks, but no.
Yeah.
But
you've said yes to some. I mean, you've played some of the greatest people that have ever in history as well. You know, Mandela and Martin Luther King, and playing people like that. That must be something so deep inside you where you just go, well, that's an honour.
Oh yeah, and you start off in panic, as you know. You always think,
did you?
Yeah, you always do. You always, it's like any part, any big part. You think, I can't do this. I can't do this. That little voice saying, I can't do that. And then you sort of, you know, especially with Mandela, you know, reading Long Walks to Freedom, which was it's an amazing book. But you sort of have to digest all of this whole icon, and then narrow it down to the man. And what I've learned now is that's all you can do is everyone's got their idea of what this person is, and there's all videotape of some of these people, but then at the end of the day you sort of just whittle it down to the man,
because you're not doing an impression.
No,
you weren't doing an impression.
I don't think so.
But
sometimes I initially was when I played Mandela, and I had to kind of soften it a little bit, but it's great to be able to experience that. And I almost met him. Because I was playing him, I was in South Africa.
Person I always wanted to meet.
So that was a bit of a shame, but it's a joy to play those people. Real joy. Playing real people is always great.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it not tougher? Because all the videos are out there.
Exactly. So you kind of think someone out there might be watching that and think that's off the mark. So you just try your best to. I do anyway. I just try my best to, you know, to give it full. Do it as honestly as I can. And one of the great things about playing William F. Buckley, who was a white conservative, how the hell I turned that down initially. I thought, there's no way I can play that. But actually getting to know him, and I, strangely enough, began to admire him in a very bizarre way. And so it was quite a fond portrayal in the end. I thought I was going to play him like some sort of cold, sort of white nationalist, but I found him very warm, humorous, very funny. Adored his wife, and yes, said some things early in the 60s that impacted the black community very badly, but changed his viewpoint after King died, and in the end was supporting civil rights. So, and sort of breaking away from the more sort of ideological elements within the white nationalist side on the right, they just sort of peeled back from that. So it was wonderful to have these elderly Americans when they saw the show going, my God, you captured him so well. And you think, you know, here's me, a black Englishman, capturing elements of William F. Buckley, a white conservative, that they actually said some, yeah, that you caught him really well. You caught
his manner. Oh, that's fantastic.
Caught his manner, caught his voice. Yeah, that's wonderful. So that's the nature of it. It's the essence of, I mean, Damien telling me that. Damien Lewis was telling me that when he auditioned for Band of Brothers, which was a huge part for him. And he told me the story when it was obviously down to two actors. And he turned up at the studio and he said he saw this square-jawed, handsome, huge American guy. And he said, obviously, that's him. He said, that is him. And he just thought, I'm not going to get this gig. The guy went in, came out. They kind of nodded on the way out. On his way out, and Damien went in, did his thing, and he got the job. And he asked the director why, and he said, it's all about essence. It's not about what you look like. It's about
that's
essence.
Really, that's so useful for every actor who's listening to this.
Just if you've got the essence of the character, you're in. Doesn't matter what you look like.
That's such good advice. With the other thing that you talk about, obviously being, you are a black actor, you're a black man. You've talked a lot about that, and I think the thing I'm most fascinated by, obviously, is the portrait being done in Harewood House and learning all of that you learnt, and about your family. And I'm heartbroken that fight is still needing to be fought, whether it's racism, homophobia, sexism, anti-Semitism.
It's crazy.
I find it utterly heartbreaking that we're in 2023.
It seems to be coming back in various places.
It's just, why?
I think...
Why is there so much hate?
We've created this, a very... antagonistic society, Twitter, you know, us and them, left, right. And our ways of communicating now are so easy, and our silos have become so defined that we kind of stop listening to each other. And, you know, it's voices on the right and voices on the left, and that's it. And I personally think that, the voices on the right are getting louder, and as they sort of lose the battle, because younger people are much more progressive, gender fluid, with race, they're much more easygoing and quickly. And I think there's an older element that are sort of hanging on to the old world, desperately want to, you know, start building walls and fences and saying, we want to stop this progressive knot. We want to keep it as it is. And it's increasingly difficult to do that. But I think those voices on the right are getting louder, and unfortunately, some of them are getting quite popular.
But also there are people who, like you, who are outspoken. Many people who are outspoken
but I don't passionate. But I don't know if there's anybody globally on the left who's got a real track for it. I think...
That people are listening to.
I don't know if there really is anybody there. I mean, I'm sure they exist, but it's worrying how the more, I say attractive voices, but the more, because they are...
The louder voices.
The louder voices are on the right. I mean, look at Brexit, you know. What was it, Farage the other day saying Brexit has failed? I mean, it's extraordinary that the man who, you know, banged on about it for so long, he's now going, you know what? It's failed. What about all the promises, Nige? What about all the things that we were supposed to get, Nige? Nothing.
Have you sat opposite him at a table?
Nothing.
Have you ever had that conversation?
No, I'm not sure how I would relate to someone like that.
I'd watch that.
I'm not. You know,
I'd watch you and Nigel Farage.
What? Well, he's articulate and political, and you know, but I'm just astonished that he still exists and BBC will still have him on the show and Sky interviewed him the other day and you know he's on GB News and you just think, oh, what have we learned from all that? Nothing. What have we got from it? Nothing.
Will you make that program?
Harewood meets Farage.
Yeah. I'll be watching. I will be watching. So all aside everything that we've said, you do smile a lot. And so I want to know what makes you properly laugh. Do you laugh? Do you belly laugh?
I used to belly. I don't laugh as
you
much.
You don't belly laugh anymore?
I do, but not as much as I used to.
Why is that?
I'm not around the people who make me belly laugh.
Who are the people that make you belly laugh?
Well, my friend who sadly passed away, that was somebody who would always make me belly laugh.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He was my best mate.
I'm so sorry.
Losing him just before I lost him. Didn't work for 9 months because I couldn't get my head together.
Yeah.
Was very nearly went under financially. And then when I got Homeland, the day I got Homeland, it was his birthday.
No, he's watching over you.
He was the guy, he always said, you're going to make it. You're going to make it. He was the only one who said, you're going to make it. So to get Homeland on his birthday, and it's literally been a
he's
step.
Watching
you. Of course he is. So I'll be...
What's his name?
Louis.
Louis.
I'll be in the garden and I'll just do something that a silly voice we used to do.
Yeah.
And I'll just be laughing.
That's lovely.
But there's not many people who can do that. And I miss them. There are a couple of people that I know that I still laugh with, but
Do you call them and say I need a laugh?
Do you know what? That's a good idea, and I should
do it.
I should, because I need to laugh more. I don't think I laugh enough.
Okay,
I used to laugh a lot.
Do you know, it's really interesting. When I sometimes put that on socials, I'll say, do me a favor today, just call that person that you were meaning to call. Everybody knows that Paul O'Grady was one of my dearest friends, and I had in my phone Call Savage and he died. And I'd put it in about 3 days before. I thought, I haven't spoken to Savage for a few weeks. And we used to speak a lot and we laughed. Oh my God, it made me laugh. So I just remind people, just call that person.
Yeah, it's important. You never know.
So do it.
I will.
After this.
I will.
All right, walk out of here and call them. That'd be so nice. What are their names?
Gary.
Okay, Gary. You expect them. Hopefully he would have called you by now, Gary. David Harewood, it's just always lovely to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for being so open.
Thank you.